Hello. Good evening. Welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is International Flavor. And I'm a tired mofo, for lack of a better word, as we used to call each other in the Army. We didn't say the actual words. You just, hey, mofo. So, you know, that way you're not swearing, right? We weren't totally evil people, right? In the Army, we were just, you know, half the time bored, right? So you spent all your time hanging out in the motor pool until it was time to go somewhere and pretend you were going to war. Of course, that was before I became the all-important interpreter. Then it was even worse. We did nothing except speak in Russian all day. That was the easiest job on the planet, I got to tell you. All we had to do was wander around, speak Russian. Well, maybe that is why I like to speak so much all the damn time. Perhaps I got used to it in the armed forces. If you feel like sending me interesting tidbits, you can do so live at damradio.com by email. I might even read them. Or you can send them to me personally at samuelt@internationalflavor.com. You may phone in. I shall allow it this evening, 573-746-8020. I must admit to having truly enjoyed last night's program. Don't know why. The topic got me all worked up. And afterward, I think I told you I was, you know, halfway through and I finished my article in Russian on the same topic. And then I sent it to the place where my prior article was published. I got a response today. And they said they do plan on publishing my article, and it's going to be put out in Ukraina.ru, and that is going to go out sometime this week, I assume. And then they asked me if I would be willing to be interviewed again. Now, when I was in Russia, they asked me to come, and I did an hour-long interview went into their TV studio. That was a lot of fun, and got quizzed about, you know, whatever events of the day were going on. But I really hadn't prepared. You know, what was I going to prepare for? I don't know what they're going to ask me. I didn't ask. It's not like I do it all the time. And I had met this, the girl who was going to interview me, or the woman, I'm sorry. I met her at the BRICS conference in Kazan in 2024. And it was, you know, I met her there. I got interviewed by her there. I got interviewed by several TV stations while I was there. And the funniest of which was the one where this very hilarious girl was running around with a poster or a picture, like a 11 by 17 framed picture of Vladimir Putin. And she wanted me to, you know, interview to talk to Putin on camera. It was actually pretty comical. She's asking me questions in Russian. It was actually turned out to be a pretty funny segment there in Russian. Some crazy American over there speaking Russian to Vladimir Putin. It was a picture of Vladimir Putin anyway. And anyway, it was pretty comical. Anyway, I have been remiss in my duties. Because when I sent my article this morning, I was, you know, I got a response back pretty quickly. You know, said, yeah, you know, I sent it last night. You know, by the time I got home and did all the upload on internationalflavor.com, where all my shows are stored, I put last night's program out there, which has also gotten a good number of views, or listens to, I suppose you would call it. By the time I got home, uploaded it, finished my article. Geez, I went to bed at like 2:33 in the morning, and then I woke up. I don't sleep. I'm the worst sleeper, and I woke up at like 5:45, and so I haven't slept. But I got a response back. So by the time I sent my response out, it was, you know, early in the morning. For us, but for them, afternoon. And I got a response back, you know, pretty handily, and said, well, you know, I've been sending you messages on Telegram, and You haven't responded. I'm glad you sent, you know, your article. And yeah, we'll, you know, we plan to publish it, you know, and we want to interview you. And they want to interview me about some of the things that are going on. You know, they like to get an American perspective in Russian. And so I've been pretty remiss in doing my Russian programming. And I used to do pretty regularly my Russian video. And I need to set up a new video studio, you know, where I can do it. I was, you know, doing it in my car. It was kind of fun and I liked it. But I got kind of burned out doing it that way. And I would much rather have a more presentable and formal Russian speaking segments that I do, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood. I don't know. It doesn't need to be longer than a half an hour and an hour or something like that, where I'd get on and do the same thing I'm doing here, but I do it in Russian. And I want that to be on video so I can put it on my YouTube channel. And I haven't really posted anything on my YouTube channel, my Russian version anyway, in a while. And but whenever they interview me, they send me a copy and I can upload it to my YouTube channel, and I plan on putting subtitles on it. And I thought about sending and asking what questions they were, you know, what do you want to talk about so I could prepare for it? But I don't really care. It's like, it's not going to change what I say. I don't, you know, it doesn't, I say what I say, you know, and if I don't know, I say, well, I don't know, you know, and it doesn't really bother me. But I suppose if this is going to be if I'm going to be something referred to as a professional journalist or something, I should probably prepare, especially going on live TV. Well, this one will be recorded, but going on live TV in front of a bunch of Russian people who would probably think I'm a nut. And, you know, and my Russian is good, but, you know, I make mistakes, and Russian is not easy. But at the same time, I know I'm understandable. I know I communicate over there pretty well. I remember one time I was in one of the sanatoriums over there, and I'd been there, I don't know, been there probably a week by the time this happened. And there was a girl who was always, she sat at the same table for lunches. You know, you got these 6-person tables or whatever where people are sitting. She was always at the same one. And you're not assigned places, but, you know, that's where, you know how it is. You end up sitting in the same place. And she was sitting there, and I ran into her in the elevator. And so I said hello to her. And she says to me in Russian, she says, don't talk to me. I was like, why not? She goes, I don't know. I don't like your accent. That was it. I was like, well, I suppose that was a little rude, you know, and sometimes you hear that kind of thing. And I remembered it from the 80s anyway, when or 90s, whenever we were there and people would go, speak English, you know, in Texas, you know, some people speaking Mexican or whatever. And I kind of felt like, wow, I guess I get the idea of being an immigrant, and I wasn't, but I mean, anyway, I don't know where I'm going with all that stupidity tonight, but I'm wondering if maybe I should prepare for that when I get interviewed this coming week. And we've already set a time. I'll keep you posted on it and see what we're going to do. So many of you know about the fights, and there's some opinion pieces I want to read tonight. First, I want to do a couple of news pieces. And those of you who've listened to my show for a long time know that I listen to quite often, or as often as I can, a show by Vladimir Solovyov, because I like the format, and I've talked about it before on quite a few occasions. Well, there's a lady who interviews there, and I've talked about her show over the you know, last year plus of my show here, and her name is Margarita Simonyan, and she usually on Sundays was on Solovyov's show. And she always got to go first. Solovyov's a gentleman and lets the women, the women speak first before he gets to the other, to the other people that speak. And she is seated. The rest of the men are standing, right? And so he does his monologue, and then he says, Margarita Simonyan, and he points at her, and she starts, right? And I always enjoyed listening to her. She talks about poetry. She speaks very well. She is 45, and I was reading some and I don't know how it came about, but I was watching something, and there's an assassination plot on her that they've been trying to kill her. And nonsense in any country, you know, and the Ukrainians are allegedly behind it. And the couple have been arrested, and I'm going to share with you the story about it. And last week was the 20th anniversary of RT News, which she is the editor-in-chief for, and has been for a long time. She's Western educated, been over and came to the U.S. for a while to do some education. She's also under sanctions. I talked about some of the sanctions against her last year, the stupidity of the of our government, our attorney general's office in many different areas, and talking about disinformation, misinformation, all of this crap. All it is news. You don't have to believe it. I don't care if you believe it or not. I read it. I'm not saying I believe all of it. I'm saying I read it because it's a different perspective. Obviously, if you're an intelligent person, you're going to get a different perspective from different places. And that's what I do. And so I've been talking about that, and I've been doing it for a long time. And I try hard not to judge people. You know, I don't give a crap. Your life is yours. Mine is mine. I got my issues. You have yours. And I try hard not to judge people. You know, what is that statement there? But for the grace of God, go I, right? You know, how do you know how you would react to how somebody else is living their life and the situations that they've had and they're giving, you know, they're growing up with? Like, to think you're a good person, but a person is also impacted dramatically by the circumstances of their lives, sometimes that they don't have a lot of control over. And so sometimes people end up making wrong choices. That's how it is. Sometimes people have evil intent, and I believe we got plenty of those in our political sphere here in the United States. Do the same exist in every other country too? Likely. Okay, does that mean you shouldn't listen to them at all? No. Listen to them, make your choices. You know, and you know, I believe the same for her. But I like listening to her. She speaks well, you know, and you know, I assume she writes pretty well too. Well, while I was looking into where she's been, because suddenly she's not been on the program for quite a few months. It's been a while. And you know, every Sunday I'm like, man, I always like listening to her. I still listen to other people. You know, I listen to the program as it goes because I like the opinions. But come to find out, she's been dealing with a husband who has had several heart attacks, has had issues, and he's been in a coma the last 4 or 5 months, and he passed away in late September. And, you know, there's some pretty nasty things being said about her and stuff that are going on. It's like, man, like her, dislike her, doesn't matter. Respect, I respect. You know, whatever her opinion is, I respect it. She argues her point. She says what she means, and she puts it out in an intelligent and reasonable light. So I respect that, right? And you have to respect that. If someone is well spoken and can say what they mean and can tell you their point of view, you don't have to agree with it. I mean, who cares? And so this is where I have a serious problem with all this disinformation. Well, last week, or this a few days ago, Putin gave a speech at the RT 20th anniversary, and he was on the same stage as her. And he spoke about, and they've known each other for a long time. And, well, she's been the head of RT, and so they, you know, speak together. RT is part of the things that I wanted to go into tonight, because we in America have this We're no better than any other country. They're trying to limit what people can say here. They're trying to limit, you know, they call things disinformation. They're charging people with crimes. I read about some agency, I forget the name of it today, but they have several of them. They have some misinformation agency that's under whether it's the Defense Intelligence Agency or a different intelligence agency, I forget. But they, I had it pulled up. I'm not going to go look for it now because I have other things to talk about tonight. But this, well, there's several of them. They built one of them for the defense, one of them for the State Department, and I forget who, Tulsi Gabbard said they were shutting it down. I believe it was her that said they're shutting down theirs. But this other agency is still alive and well, and their goal is to combat mainly Russian disinformation, including Margarita Simonyan. And I told you about probably a year ago, about the charges against RT contributors, the seizing of their property by our government, because they have an opinion different, and they were paying people to broadcast stories, supportive of RT or supportive of RT's point of view, certain podcast hosts. And they were charging these podcast hosts with putting them out there. So I'm sitting here reading sometimes RT stories. This is such crap that they can come back and say that's these people. And what they did was they called it, since they were paying these podcast hosts $100,000 or whatever, a year or whatever they were getting paid, who knows? These were big-time podcasters that had lots of people. And so Russia Today was paying these people to distribute or to consider distribution of their content. They were putting it out. And so what they did was they called it conspiracy. And if you charge somebody with a conspiracy, what can you do? You can seize their property. And so what they were doing is confiscating their bank accounts, confiscating their property, and going and seizing properties of the Russian government or of Russian RT people as some sort of sanction, and taking their money, taking their bank accounts, taking their homes or property that they owned in the United States. My view, that's freaking un-American, and I've been against it since I first heard about it. Now, for the purposes that they're saying, conspiracy to provide disinformation to interfere with an election, okay? What a load of crap, no matter how you slice it. And by the way, they don't have to prove anything, because even before you ever have an appearance in front of the judge, guess what you get? You get the confiscation order. You get the seizure of your property. That is just part of the deal. You get to confiscate anything having to do with ill-gotten gains. And they didn't take the $100,000 from the podcasters. They took the property of RT or of the people that worked for RT, not the podcasters. Those guys who were like, look, you just shut your mouths and move out smartly and you don't have anything. This is our government, people. This is such crap. What a load of crap. And if you're supportive of that kind of thing, well, you're part of the problem. That's all I got to say. And, people should be, how in the world are words, what in the world is misinformation, disinformation? And you always have to hear the word Russian in front of it, right? So Russian disinformation, all it is contrary information. It's information from a different perspective, from a different point of view. You don't have to agree. Nobody's requiring you to agree. Nobody even is requiring you to listen. It's such crap. And now we have an agency dedicated dedicated to Russian disinformation, or people that spread disinformation or misinformation on Facebook. What, are we going to end up like Europe? You know, you can't put anything on Facebook, or you're going to get arrested because you put something out there. I told you that when the February 24 of whatever it was, 24 of 2022, when Russia went into the Donbass region, and there were all these people with these Ukrainian flags all over their Facebook. Nobody stopped them, but I put up on my Facebook a Russian flag. Put a Russian flag on my Facebook. I put a letter Z on top of that. And the Z for a za, and za means for, you know, and it's for Russia, basically. And all I was doing was putting a different point of view out of there and saying, if you believe what's going on in Ukraine, it's just wrong. And our government is going to crazy lengths to silence people of a different opinion. And it's been going on for far too long. Nonsensical nonsense. At any rate, I wanted to share with you these two who were charged in an assassination plot against the RT chief. These two members of a neo-Nazi group have been charged with planning to assassinate RT editor-in-chief Margarita Simonyan, the Russian Investigative Committee has put out. The investigation into the case has been completed and handed over to prosecutors. Simonyan posted on X that she was thankful to those who prevented the planned attack. My deepest gratitude to law enforcement officers for their work, she said. The assassination plot against the RT editor-in-chief was prepared by members of a Moscow-based cell of the banned National Socialism White Power Group, according to the agency. The cell, called Pure Bloods, was set up in 2022 by a guy named Mikhail Balashov, who recruited 11 people with National Socialist and racist views. Additionally, on the order of unidentified individuals, Balashov and the cell's other member, Igor Savolyov, agreed to kill journalist Margarita Simonyan for a cash reward of $50,000. They gathered data on the RT editor-in-chief's whereabouts and obtained the firearms, but were detained by officers from Russia's Federal Security Service, FSB, before being able to carry out the murder. Balashov and Savolyov have been charged with illegal possession of weapons and preparation for murder. Together with other members of the cell, they are accused of creating a terrorist group. Hooliganism, I always love that word, hooliganstva, is how it is in Russian, hooliganstva, and inciting hatred, the agency said. Earlier reports suggested the hit on Simonyan had been ordered by the Ukrainian Security Service, the SBU, which in 2023 accused her of calling for mass killings of Ukrainian children. That's absolutely untrue, but failed to provide any proof to back that claim. The RT editor-in-chief said at the time that the false accusations were an attempt by Ukraine to make a possible hit on her appear more palatable. Palatable. Sorry about that. Moscow has accused Kyiv of the assassination of several prominent Russian officials and public figures since the escalation of the Ukraine conflict, including Chemical Defense Chief General Igor Kirillov and journalist Darya Dugina, the daughter of philosopher Alexander Dugin. And, you know, there's people and there are strong ties to the terrorist attack at the theater, the Crocus, that happened in Moscow when the gunmen went in, automatic weapons, killed 140 people, 145 people who were waiting for a concert to start, just shooting people while they sat there, sitting, families, kids, just shot them all. And, I mean, there were thousands of people in there. And, you know, they were, you know, on the payroll of Ukraine, and that is of the SBU, and unbelievable. crazy stuff goes on in this world. And, you know, you don't have to love Russia. you know, I think Russia's pretty cool. I think there's no reason that Russia is our enemy. That's for sure. And I'm pretty clear about that. I don't think there's any reason Ukraine's our enemy. I don't believe Russia wants to take over the planet like everybody says. And I think we made huge mistakes since 1991 when I was in the diplomatic corps doing arms control. I think we made huge mistakes. And the idiots that are running the show now, hopefully Trumpster is not one of them. And it appears that he's not. Oh, there's some crazy stuff going on There's one funny story. Well, it's really not funny. It's terrible. So Ukraine is full of blackouts right now. And they're going to have a ton of problems when winter comes. They are losing, and that's not going to change. So Zelensky's aides have advised Ukrainians during the blackouts to meditate. People should manage their stress and blame Russia for power outages. So she's a presidential advisor, and she says they should practice. She has urged citizens to practice breathing exercises during prolonged power outages, and insisted that Russia, not the Ukraine government, is responsible for all of their suffering. Russia has intensified its own long-range strikes on Ukrainian energy infrastructure, saying the attacks aim to degrade Kyiv's arms production and military logistics, and to retaliate for Ukrainian drone strikes on Russian energy sites. Timofey Milovanov, a member of the advisory board of the Ukraine state nuclear company, Energoatom, and an advisor to the presidential office, shared his stress-managing recommendations in a Facebook post on Sunday. He said, "Regular blackouts are likely to continue through the winter as the country faces mounting strain on its energy grid." "How should one prepare?" he said. "First of all, mentally and psychologically, breathing exercises are the simplest method. Inhale for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds, exhale for 4 seconds, and pause for 4. A few such cycles send the brain a signal that everything is under control." He advised Ukrainians to keep their emotions in check despite the long blackouts, cold meals, gridlock, and constant fear of airstrikes. "People must remember that the cause is Russia and no one else," he said. Ukraine's Vladimir Zelensky on Monday reiterated his refusal to compromise with Moscow. The Ukraine government is calling instead for greater Western military aid to expand long-range attacks on Russian territory, claiming that that strategy enjoys public backing. In contrast to those assertions, the Ukrainian military is suffering from widespread draft evasion and more than 100,000 desertions this year, by the way. Moscow has maintained that the conflict stems from NATO's eastward expansion, as I've covered for plenty of time. An early peace deal reached in 22 collapsed after interim, blah, blah, blah. We already know that part. I just found the, how do you deal with blackouts? So Americans, Lake Ozarkans, if you're sitting at home, the power goes out, breathe in, 4 second hold, breathe out, 4 second pause, and then do it all over again. For a few times of that, tell you what, everything will be just fine when the power goes out. That is how you should deal with it. So all of the news, well, you know what? I'm going to do this opinion piece first. There's so many. I would love to get into more than one, but I'm not going to. I'm going to stick with this one. Came out today. When a tomahawk becomes a boomerang. And it's talking about Zelensky's latest Washington humiliation. Now, I told you a little bit about this before. And this is not horribly long, but I'm going to share the whole thing with you. This is by a guy that I share with you reasonably often. He is Tariq Cyril Amar, who's a historian from Germany, and he works in Istanbul. And, you know, he's a Russian, Ukrainian, Eastern European expert. And here's his interesting take on the Zelensky and Trump meeting, which I'm going to cover a little bit more of as well. Leave it to Mr. Unpredictable, a.k.a. Donald Trump, President of the United States, to pack a policy U-turn, a harsh unfriending, and some fuzzy ambiguity into just a few days. As things stand now, Trump has said no to American Tomahawk cruise missiles for Kyiv. Maybe not yet forever, as Vice President J.D. Vance has stressed, but clearly, for the foreseeable future, whatever that may mean with Trump. In the process, he has also made it clear, painfully clear, that Kyiv's Vladimir Zelensky is back in the doghouse, seemingly in favor for a while, after donning a suit like a good little boy and flattering Trump at every opportunity and without inhibition. The Ukrainian leader without elections is out of in the cold again. No welcome at the airport. A Friday afternoon meeting demonstratively scheduled to get a nuisance visitor out of the way before the weekend. And we hear some rough talk, even shouting again. It is as if Zelensky did not board a plane to pay another submission visit to Washington, but a time machine. And it deposited him right back in February when he received an urgently needed public drubbing in the Oval Office. Compulsive optimists among the thinning crowd of deadly friends of Ukraine in the West. Oh, did you see the one? I got to interrupt this. I forgot about this. He is walking toward the White House or outside, and he's walking in downtown Washington, D.C. I know exactly where he was. And he's walking down the street, and there's a couple of people with him. And there are, says the caption under the picture says a huge crowd visit, you know, waits for Zelensky. And there are two people standing out there with Ukrainian flags, and that's it. I'm thinking that the worm has turned for the government. For the people of America, you know, just saying, oh, geez, we love everything about Ukraine. And I think that people are finally seeing the reality here. It's not our deal, never was our deal, never should have been our deal. But anyway, I thought that was, I hate to laugh about it, you know, pretty comical, but the friends of Ukraine in the West may want to take solace in the fact that this time Trump had the decency to administer Zelensky's spanking behind closed doors. But then it was leaked immediately to the Financial Times. Of course, the leaker may have been a desperate pro-Zelensky holdout still hiding somewhere in the U.S. administration. Is that you, Keith Kellogg? Trying to alert the Europeans so they can come again to their Ukrainian protege's aid and sabotage the oh-so-horrible prospect of a quick peace deal. And according to Maria Zakharova, speaking for the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they have already started interfering again. That was an interesting article. Lucky Ukrainians, you have a government that feeds you into a lost meat grinder war for which your Western friends from hell once promised you NATO. Remember that one? Never mind, it was always a transparent lie. And now they promise simply nothing. And you have diehard European supporters who fear nothing more than that this bloody scam will stop while some of you are still alive. If the leak really came from someone attempting to sabotage Trump, we'll hear about a dismissal soon. Come to think of it, the designated U.S. delegation for Budapest does not seem to include Kellogg, as it just so happens. Yet we probably will not, because the better explanation is that it came from the very top and was meant to make Zelensky's crash just as public as last time. Finally, with the forget about it on the tomahawks and the big bruising unfriending came the message on how to end the war. This time, Trump had no time for silly fairy tales about Kyiv still turning it around and winning. His blunt message was that Kyiv must make concessions, including all of the Donbass. According to the Rapid Leak, Zelensky's attempt to present his fantasy maps of Russian weak spots met with a brusque reaction. What does it all mean, and where did it come from? Regarding where it came from, let's get one popular take out of the way. Yes, Trump had just had a phone conversation with President Vladimir Putin. In fact, the longest of the eight we know about since Trump's second inauguration. The talk went well, as was shown by both immediate Western reports, if the NATO, EU, Europe especially, often in a sour mood, and Russian reactions. Most importantly, the presidents agreed to meet in person again soon, this time in the Hungarian capital of Budapest. And I'm going to tell you quite a bit about that tonight when we get to it here. That choice is clearly due to the fact that Hungary, next to Slovakia, has been the only EU government to stay rational about the Ukraine war, affirming a belief in diplomacy instead of forever war. The whole mainstream EU and UK, meanwhile, has furiously maneuvered itself into irrelevance. Yet, the conversation between Putin and Trump does not mean that Moscow has manipulated oh-so-naive Trump into changing his approach, as claimed again, rather arrogantly, by many hapless Western commentators and Kyiv politicians, such as Alexander Merezka, chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of Ukraine's parliament. Mr. Trump fell again for Putin's old trick, Merezka wants to believe or make us believe. The reality is, obviously, that Trump is not being tricked at all. On the contrary, he understands key things that Kyiv, not Moscow, has done its utmost to deceive him about. Ukraine cannot win. Russia is winning. Tomahawks will not change these facts but make the war much worse again, in particular by increasing the risk of a regional or even global escalation, which may well be the real aim of the desperate gamblers clinging on in Kyiv. And even if Russia were once again to show the restraint that the West so sorely lacks, there can be little doubt that it would retaliate massively inside of Ukraine. The U.S., of course, would never have sold enough Tomahawks to make a difference. Again, as I reported last week. As even halfway honest Western experts note, the weapons themselves, while dangerous, are fairly old, originally developed half a century ago, and slow, subsonic, in an age of hypersonic cutting edge. Remember, they're only 0.5 to 0.75 Mach. Remember that? And so under a Mach, Russian hypersonics are over 10 Mach. The Oreshnik is anyway. That's what the Ukrainians reported. Their use would have involved U.S. targeting data and personnel, as I've also reported, a new stage of escalation, as the Russian president has explicitly warned. Withholding Tomahawk missiles from Kyiv is very likely to also have to do with strategic priorities at the Pentagon. The current brain, Policy Chief Elbridge Colby has made no secret out of his correct view that a proxy war against Russia in Europe is a short-sighted waste of resources at the very best, which, so Colby incorrectly believes, should be reserved for a potential conflict with China in Asia. I saw that too. That was nuts. Colby's name has already been associated with a temporary halt in supplies to Ukraine this summer. In the Tomahawk debate, he has stayed quiet, but he has certainly not been passive. So what does it all mean? That's where things get tricky, especially with Trump. We have just been through a phase of, if not aggressiveness, then pronounced rhetorical toughness toward Moscow, which followed a period of eager rapprochement and complimentary iciness toward Kyiv. Now we're back where we started. Ukraine is out. Russia is in again. Trump himself has acknowledged that he thinks of others, including Moscow, as trying to play him. But he doesn't really mind. That's, of course, a way of admitting that he's playing as well. And frankly, why should Moscow mind? Yet, as a minimum, it means that what Trump says and does on any given day can be either a strategic move or a tactical ploy, or potentially both, depending on how things work out. And that is where the fuzzy ambiguity we have mentioned at the beginning comes into play. Once the great Zelensky bashing leak was out, Trump started backpedaling and contradicting the leaked information. Whereas, according to the leak, he had twisted Zelensky's arm to giving up all of the Donbass, the next day he started telling journalists that he's in favor of freezing the front line where it is now. These two positions are irreconcilable because Moscow has not yet completely taken this area, but as far as we know, aims to have all of it as a condition for peace. And there we are, and remain, in Trump world, where the ground is never quite firm, and yet some opportunities may be real. Moscow has shown restraint, not only in the war, resisting a long sequence of Western provocation that could easily have made the war all European or global. Russia also has a record of staying calm in the face of Trump's turns, and rightly so. There is a chance that his no to the Tomahawks will solidify. His realistic distrust of Kyiv will stay in place, and a door for peaceful compromise will open. That is what every sane and decent person should want for all of us and also for Ukraine. I hope you don't mind me sharing that article in its entirety with you, but, you know, the guy's well-spoken, and he's absolutely right. And, you know, Trump, God love him, is all over the map. And who's to say that next week he won't change again? I hope he doesn't. I hope he sticks with this. The smart move, as I've said for years now, I feel like I'm a broken record, is to cut these guys off. This would be over in no time. And it's probably going to end on those terms anyway. But if something happens and all these European numbnuts continue to do what they're doing to harpoon any sort of resolution of the entire conflict, not just a ceasefire so Ukraine can rebuild and we go through it all again. I agree with the Russians on this, and I've been pretty clear about that. If this war is actually over and Russia is going to... Here's what I believe. I believe that there was a phone call between Putin and Trump. And I believe... Now, there's been... Most of the reports say that Putin is the one that called Trump. Okay. And he did it, and I was sitting there thinking about this strategically. Now, if this is true, and God, I don't know, you know, I've seen almost all of it has been that Putin called Trump. And when did he call him? He called him on Thursday, right? I suppose it might have been Wednesday afternoon, but I'm pretty sure it was Thursday. And the old Z monster is going to meet with Trump on Friday. So Putin sabotaged the meeting with Zelensky, because up until that time, we were hearing all about tomahawks. You know, there was, I was like, oh my God, we're actually going to do it? You hear Trump talking about this stuff. You got idiots like Kellogg running around going, oh, it's going to be great. You know, we're going to bomb the hell out of them. Then you got me going, what are you going to do? Throw them at them? You got no way to launch them. We're not going to launch them from our subs or our ships. And, you know, we went over all that last week. And then all of a sudden, Putin calls Trump. Next day, Trump's like, you know, I don't think we can afford to give away any tomahawks. And, you know, I've been talking to Putin, and we need to meet. We're going to meet in Budapest. And Z-Man, you got to give up the Donbass. And if you don't, you're probably going to lose. You know, he didn't tell him this, but I'm telling him this. You don't, Putin's going to take it anyway. Might take him a little bit. But I bet you anything that what Putin said to Trump is, listen, you give up tomahawks, you're making a huge mistake. All through the week, they're saying those are nuclear capable weapons. What are we supposed to do? Let them be shot into our territory with American targeting and not take it as a response that we need to make a nuclear response? I think you're playing with fire. Don't do it. That's number one. Number two, even if you do, it ain't going to change anything. We're still going to beat the hell out of them. It's not going to change what we have. And how many are you going to send? It's not going to work. Number three, he said, I bet, he said, listen, I will make a deal with you. You get that little wanker, the Z-Man, to give up Zaporozhye, Kherson, and the Donbass, which is Donetsk and Lugansk. You get him to give those up so we don't have to keep killing people to get them, because we're going to take them. We're not stopping until we get them. Those people have had referenda, and those referenda, they voted for us, and they're out. And then you find somebody to get rid of any NATO aspirations. Not going to happen. We don't care if they join the EU. He said that before. And then you have elections and get us somebody that can sign the peace deal. We're not going to, I'm sure that he probably told him again, because everybody said it, there will be no ceasefire for the sake of a ceasefire. We will do it, and we'd be happy to talk about it. Who refused the Istanbul continuations? Zelensky. Those have been refused since July. And before that, they were in, was it Saudi Arabia or was it Qatar? I think it was Saudi Arabia. But they canceled those too after they were done. Ceasefires weren't honored. Nothing there. There is nothing positive that has been done on the Ukrainian side to stop this war. It's always, we want everything back. Russia bad, we're good, the end. Nonsense. Not going to work. Anyway, that is my rant on that particular topic. And I wanted to go into this other part. Where are we? We want to talk about, you know, the map being totally louder than any microphone. You know, especially with what's coming up with Putin and Trump going to meet here in a little bit, right? Supposedly in the next couple of weeks. So the map is louder than these microphones. Brussels is scolding. The ICC is waving paper around, saying we're going to arrest Putin. And Hungary, small on the map, enormous in the moment, has stepped into a role of a self-appointed guardian of European values and is refusing to play along with the other Europeans. Instead, they're going to offer the room as a host. They're going to guarantee the door. They're going to let the real leaders talk, Putin and Trump. By the way, I believe Z-Man isn't invited. And that's all they're doing. They're not going to lecture. They're not going to give hashtags. No photo op summits that produce communiques and casualties in the same breath. Just a table in Budapest and an opportunity for Washington and Moscow to stop a war the rest of Europe claims it wants ended, so long as someone else does the ending of it. You've heard it. Putin can't come. He must be detained. It would be, what's the word? Not nice. It's not nice for him. Oh, spare us. International law is not a kindergarten sticker chart. The ICC, International Criminal Court, can issue documents. It cannot conjure a police force out of a press release. The European Union can posture. It cannot put handcuffs on a foreign head of state without a sovereign member deciding to act. And the sovereign member in this story has already said something very simple. We will host the talks. We will ensure safe entry and safe exit. That is what grown-ups do when they want peace more than they want applause. So let's set the stage. If a summit happens in Budapest, the question is not theoretical. Will somebody dare? It's a practical question. How does the plane get there? This is where the rhetoric ends and the air corridors begin. Because in the real world, look at that. Diplomacy isn't just words. It's a flight plan. It's overflight permission. It's who picks up the phone in Ankara, in Sofia, in Belgrade and says, send it. It's whether an Ilyushin 96 with call sign Russia gets a corridor over the Black Sea and the Balkans, or whether a single waiver in a single capital opens a sky that the EU insists is sealed to Russia. The irony writes itself. The loudest voices claiming to defend Europe's security are terrified of the one thing that actually reduces risk. Leaders in the same room. You want to talk about security? Let's talk about security like adults. The movie scene is missiles and dogfights. The real scene is electronics, navigation interference, GPS spoofing, jamming along the eastern flank. That's why state flights don't rely on wishful thinking or social media. They fly with redundancies, inertial navigation, radio beams, plan A, B, C, plus two alternates you'll never hear about until the dust is settled. Inside Russian airspace, expect a visible fighter escort, because the point of visibility is deterrence. Beyond that, it's coordination, not theater. No one in NATO wants a high-risk air incident in EU skies. No one in Kiev wants to lose the support of the very governments keeping their lights on. If you're hearing fantasies about shoot downs to stop diplomacy, turn them off. Adults have work to do. Now to the politics you won't hear. The same officials who call a Putin visit unthinkable also acknowledge that there is no formal EU travel ban on the man himself. Sanctions are about assets and airframes, not the physical right of a head of state to walk through a door if the host invites him, which means the obstacle is not the person, it's the paperwork on the aircraft and the willpower in the corridor states. Solve those two, and the rest is just choreography. Late filed routes, tight timing, no leaks. Wheels down in Budapest, motorcade to a guarded venue, phones off, translators in, doors closed. That's where the war stops, behind those doors, not behind a podium. Meanwhile, the battlefield continues to do what battlefields do in late October. Grind. You've seen the same map for months with different arrows, but here's the truth. Ceasefires freeze lines. Every kilometer matters before talks. That's why both commands pushing now to lock in reality before negotiators lock in treaty language. You can love or hate the idea of freezing the front, but there's no honest argument against fewer funerals this winter. If the choice is a ceasefire along current lines or another mobilization cycle with less electricity and more obituaries, most civilians in this story don't need a pollster to decide. What brings us, which brings us to Washington, where we were told to expect historic unity after another round of handshakes. What actually emerged was something far more realistic. No tomahawks. The rhetoric about decisive new capability met the arithmetic of stockpiles and escalation. Cruise missiles are not candy. You don't hand them out to brighten someone's day. And if your strategy is to stop the dying and start the talking, you don't throw the most escalatory hardware on the table the week you're exploring a meeting in the heart of the European Union. That isn't restraint, it's logic. On the other side of the lectern, Kyiv's public line remains. No land, no concession, even as everyone hears the whisper underneath. A ceasefire that halts the bleeding where it is today is better than the losses required to move the map an inch tomorrow. You can call it realism, you can call it fatigue, you can call it triage. What you cannot call it is victory. Wars end either with decisive defeat or reluctant compromise. If the latter is all that's left, then the work is drawing a line that nobody loves and building guarantees people can live with. That's what Budapest offers. Not utopia, but an exit. And Budapest matters for another reason. It exposes the split inside of Europe that think tanks keep glossing over. On one side, capitals that prefer statements to solutions. On the other, a single government that says, we will host, we will protect, we will take the heat. You can demonize that as disloyalty. Orban is disloyal to the EU. I call it leadership because leadership isn't just aligning with the loudest club in the room. It's absorbing the cost of doing what the moment requires, the right thing. If the reward for that is a shrug from Brussels and a sneer from the rest, history will be kinder than the headlines. So let's walk through the legal reality. What can the ICC say? What can the sovereign host do? Where can those lines actually cross? The likely routes, Black Sea, Turkey, EU, practical measures that make a head of state flight boringly safe instead of theatrically risky. We can talk about escorts, air policing, why the smartest protection is secrecy. We'll break down the Washington-Kyiv aftertaste. No tomahawks, ceasefire whispers growing, and we'll, talk about freezing the line today rather than bleeding out tomorrow. Because if one corridor opens, one plane lifts off, one meeting happens, this winter might be measured in negotiations and not eulogies. And if the people who are complaining about niceness can't stomach that, then they can write a strongly worded letter while the rest of us try to end a war. And that's what I think we need to do. So let's start by talking about the International Criminal Court. It has a warrant in place for Vladimir Putin, which was issued on March 17. Hey, isn't that St. Paddy's Day? On March 17, 2023, by pretrial chamber number 2. That's a real judicial act. The paper does exist. The court says it concerns unlawful transfers of children from conflict zones. That's the court claim. But here's the part many pundits skip. The ICC has no blue-helmeted police. It lives and dies, but what a state does. If a state party decides to arrest someone, the warrant has a bite. If a state party declines, the court can scold them, refer, and convene, but it cannot deploy bailiffs. That's not a value judgment. That's how the Rome Statute was built. Article 86 sets a general duty to cooperate. Article 89 is the engine for arrest and surrender through national authorities. In other words, the ICC asks and states act or do not. Now let's talk about immunity. The ICC's appeals chamber in the Jordan al-Bashir decision in 2019 held that a sitting head of state cannot rely on personal immunity to defeat an ICC arrest request before an international court. Yeah, but they don't apply it to Netanyahu, do they? That was the court's answer to years of you can't touch a head of state arguments. It has since been cited to say that state parties must execute ICC warrants even when a traveler is a foreign leader. Legally neat, but politically very messy. Because even after that ruling, the ICC still couldn't make arrests without a willing host. The judicial doctrine is pretty strong on paper. The enforcement is only as strong as the sovereign will at the airport. So enter Hungary. Budapest has chosen a lane. It began the formal process to withdraw from the Rome Statute in 2025. That's the ICC. Under Article 127, though, withdrawal takes a year from notification. So the ICC itself has publicly recorded June 2nd of 2026 as the effective date. Translation, until that date arrives, Hungary is technically still a state party, and on the court's reading, still bound to cooperate. But the practical consequence of non-cooperation is not a dramatic extradition squad. It's an ICC referral to the Assembly of State Parties for a political follow-up. Precisely what we've already seen when Hungary declined to arrest Israel's prime minister during his April visit. Again, paper versus police. And at that time in April, they hadn't said they were withdrawing from the Rome Statute yet. So what about the European Union? You've heard sound bites. EU foreign policy chief Kaja Kallas, of course, called a Putin visit to an EU capital not nice. Colorful optics, but the EU is not a prosecutorial authority. It does not run jails. It does not command national police. The EU's institutions can urge member states to execute ICC requests and can harmonize the law, but arrest power is national. That's why even the EU's own messaging stresses that member states, not Brussels, carry the obligation to act on ICC warrants. So when commentators say the EU will arrest him, they're waving a flag the treaties don't give them. Only Hungary, as the host, can arrest him. Now, let's separate two different legal lanes that get conflated. Lane one is criminal cooperation, ICC warrant. Lane two is sanctions and travel restrictions. Here, the headlines have shifted in the last 72 hours. The European Commission spokeswoman, Anita Hipper, clarified on the record that Putin and Lavrov are under asset freezes, not EU travel bans. Whatever you think of that politically, legally, it means no EU-level bar that stops them from entering EU territory if a member state admits them. The sanctions regime restricts aircraft, banking, logistics, and more. But on the narrow question, is there a formal EU travel ban on one person? The commission says no. That makes the arrest him at the border because sanctions say so talking point a non-starter. The debate slides to the ICC lane and again, Hungary's choice. So what does Hungary's choice look like in practice? If Putin lands in Budapest for a summit, there are three forks. Fork one, Hungary decides to execute the ICC request, detains Putin, and moves towards surrender proceedings. Politically implausible, given everything Budapest has stated, but that's the template the court would prefer. Fork two, Hungary admits him, doesn't arrest him, and later gets referred to the ICC for non-compliance, like it did after the Netanyahu visit. That's the most likely scenario if a summit occurs and the ICC submits a cooperation request. Fork three, the visit is structured in a way that either avoids a triggered request, timing, notice, or is shielded by conflicting national provisions, arguments Hungary has floated before. But none of those forks involve the EU marching in with handcuffs. The only enforcement muscle belongs to Hungary. So let's talk about the al-Bashir precedent. Could that force Hungary's hand? Legally, the ICC says yes. The appeal chamber told Jordan in 2019 that it failed to comply by not arresting a visiting head of state. But note what happened next. Jordan was criticized, not invaded, and the world moved on. The court logged an entry in its long file titled Arrest Cooperation Challenges. That's a stubborn reality of international criminal law. Compliance is political. Countries comply when it aligns with their interests, and they deflect it when it doesn't. Budapest is signaling loudly that hosting talks to stop a European war outweighs performing for an audience in The Hague. Agree or disagree, that's what the calculus is. What about the argument you'll hear from Brussels? If we want peace, we've already heard this one, it's nonsense. If we want peace, Ukraine must be in the room and the ICC must be respected. Fine, invite Ukraine and let the ICC register its position. But those are separate questions from physically barring entry. Even EU-friendly outlets spent the weekend acknowledging that the commission's own clarification undercuts the he can't come in mantra. If the host, Hungary, opens the door and the corridor is arranged, the legal obstacles are reduced to one: whether Hungary chooses to execute the ICC request on its own soil. The rest is political theater. One more correction for people casually invoking international law as if it were a single code book with a 911 number. The Rome Statute is a treaty. States consented to it. States implement it. States withdraw from it under Article 127. The ICC has been explicit that Hungary's withdrawal, effective June 2nd, 2026, doesn't let it off current obligations. But until and unless Budapest cooperates, the court's only hard tool is to name it and shame it before the Assembly of State Parties. That's why Netanyahu's episode ended in a referral, not a perp walk. The system is designed to pressure them, not to compel them. So the bottom line is, the ICC can issue, EU can opine, only Hungary can arrest. So it's not hypocrisy. You know, that's how it is. So, you know, if Orban wants to, you know, that's what, you know, that's what he will do. He's not going to, but there you go. So I already told you about the travel ban. Let's see. We already talked about, can he enter at all? Let's see. I want to talk a little bit more about Kaja Kallas. She's nuts. Of course, Brussels isn't thrilled. The EU's top diplomat, Kaja Kallas, described the prospect of a Putin visit to an EU country as not nice. The phrase has become the meme of the week and also the tell. Not nice is neither a statute nor a sanction. It's an opinion about optics. Asked what the EU can actually do, officials pivot back to the ICC line or general disapproval. But the EU don't command national police. They don't issue aviation derogations for sovereign airspace. Member states do. So the bloc can scold, but only Hungary can comply. So where I wanted to get to, where is this? No. Let's fold in, what is Russia saying about this? They've been pretty blunt. Budapest guaranteed passage. ICC is political law fail. Rear story is one EU capital is willing to facilitate talks. Others just posture. Ukraina.ru, the same paper that's going to publish my article, emphasize Hungary's peace positioning and Orban's pragmatism. For years, he has argued that dialogue, not pressure, is the only way to end a war on European soil. You don't have to agree with him. But, you know, Orban's ties with both leaders make Hungary uniquely suited to actually perhaps have some success. Now let's talk about the realistic routes, paperwork, and the games of all this, because I found this quite interesting. Let's talk air If Budapest is the venue, the real drama isn't the courthouse, it's 35,000 feet. The question is, how does he fly? Because within the European Union, the sanctions regime blocks Russian-owned, Russian-controlled, or Russian-operated aircraft from taking off, landing, or overflying EU territory under Article 3D of Regulation 833 of 2014. That is the brick wall, but the same rule contains a door. Member states can grant one-off waivers for defined public interest reasons. So what's the translation of that? If one EU capital authorizes a state flight corridor, the flight becomes lawful and the politics shift from impossible to imminent. Now, who opens the door? In the last 24 hours, Bulgaria publicly signaled readiness to provide an air corridor for a Budapest summit flight. That isn't a rumor. It's on the record from Sofia, picked up across European and Russian outlets. A single corridor authorization is precisely the mechanism 3D anticipates when it says member states can exceptionally permit operations for humanitarian or other purposes consistent with the regulation's objective. If Bulgaria signs this paper, he can't reach the EU capital in Hungary, that point's just gone. So let's look at the realistic route. How do we make the track a professional flight planner would present when the principals say, make this work? Route A would be the Black Sea to Turkey, to Bulgaria, to Serbia, to Hungary. Operationally elegant and politically plausible, but it's a long route. When I flew from Miami to Kazan last year. So Kazan is north of the Black Sea, okay? Pretty much in the middle, I suppose. It's about 4 hours, I think, south of Moscow, and it's a couple hours to the Black Sea. And in order to get there, here's what happened. It's wartime, right? So you can't fly over the Black Sea. And previously, when I went to Naberezhny Chelny, I flew into Kazan for that trip back in, I don't remember, 2022 or 23. And that flight was much shorter. So the flight from Miami to Istanbul is 12, 13 hours. And, you know, that's uncomfortable. But the flight from Istanbul to Kazan was only like 3 hours. Last year, it was 6 because you have to go all the way around the Black Sea. So, because you can't fly over it, you know, no fly zone, Black Sea. Can't do commercial air over there. So, the same thing is what, you know, they're talking about. Obviously, the direct route to Hungary from Moscow would be through Ukraine. But even if he went through Belarus and through Poland... Poland? I wouldn't fly over Poland if I was him. Those guys are nuts. And then I can't remember if Hungary touches Poland. I think it does, but I don't remember. He might have had another state to go through. Romania, I think. But I don't remember. I'm not looking at a map either. But I know it would be Belarus and then Poland and then maybe one more country and then Hungary. Well, so the Black Sea route, you got to go... Black Sea, Turkey, Bulgaria, Serbia, Hungary. Operationally, you know, this could work. Turkey is NATO, but not the EU. Turkey's a member of NATO, but not EU. Therefore, they're not bound by the EU's airframe ban. Serbia is outside of the EU, too, and is friendly to the idea of talks. Bulgaria is a crucial corridor segment into the heart of Europe, and then Budapest on a short final route. So this route is the route corridor the news is pointing toward. It's short. It's really not. It's long. It limits EU exposure to a single authorizing state, and it conforms to the sanctions architecture. The aircraft remains blocked except where a national derogation explicitly covers the overflight. Route B would be Black Sea, Turkey, Greece, or Romania, then Serbia and Hungary. Technically, simple. Politically, harder. Greece or Romania would need to issue the same waiver that Bulgaria said they would do. It's doable on paper because Article 3D allows member state exemption, just like it does for Bulgaria. But it would require Athens or Bucharest to wear the political heat Brussels is radiating this week. They're not happy. Still, if you see late-breaking transport ministry statements from either of those capitals, you know that Route B could be alive. Route C, the long Mediterranean hook. This is the one I saw that somebody was floating earlier. Some aviation trackers have gamed a long profile that keeps the aircraft in non-EU skies for as long as possible, angles it north only at the last moment through a single EU corridor. Think Turkey, Mediterranean, Balkans, and then Hungary. It's fuel costly and time-consuming, but long detours are standard when political overflight is tight. An industry site mapped a 5,000-kilometer alternative that adds several hours exactly for this reason. All three of these routes have the same beating heart, one EU waiver for one state flight. And yes, that's within EU rules when a government says waiver serves legitimate public interest. Here, peace talks that Brussels claims it welcomes if they help achieve peace in Ukraine. What do you think? What about Hungary? The Kremlin explained why Budapest was chosen. Prime Minister Orban has warm relations with Trump and constructive relations with Putin, which is diplomatic shorthand for a credible host and reliable logistics. Hungary has signaled safe entry and exit. Open the door, guard the room, let the adults talk. Brussels can call it not nice, but the EU institutions didn't issue air corridors. Sovereign ministries do. That's why it stops being a morality play the moment Sofia, Athens, or Bucharest signs a deal. So now let's talk about security. The real risk in the Black Sea and Balkans is electronic GPS jamming and spoofing. Europe's aviation regulator, EASA, has been warning operators since 2022 and updated its safety bulletins in 24 and 25, noticing the spike in interference events along conflict-adjacent corridors. That's why state flight plans for non-GNSS navigation, inertial systems, radio beacons, procedural fixes, and they file late to reduce targeting of the route by politics or pranks. Expect route opacity, redundant alternatives, and the kind of boring professional risk management that they don't show on social media. Inside the Russian flight information region, you'll see familiar fighter escorts, Su-30s or 35s, on the wing through domestic airspace because visibility deters nonsense. Once the jets exit Russian control and enter foreign skies, escorts become diplomatic arrangements, not photo opportunities. You can hear chatter about Turkish F-16s shepherding the Black Sea segment, but unless Ankara confirms it, treat it as a rumor. What matters is clearance and corridor, not selfies. The airframe here is almost certainly the Ilyushin 96-300PU, the Flying Kremlin, a long-range, four-engine state aircraft with hardened communications and usual countermeasures you'd expect on a head-of-state platform. Don't expect to get a spec sheet. The important fact is range and reliability. It can comfortably do the legs required for any of the routes we laid out. Will politics try to ambush the flight? Of course, Europe has a precedent. In 2013, several EU states denied overflight to Bolivian President Evo Morales, forcing a diversion to Vienna amid rumors about Edward Snowden. That incident lives in every protocol officer's muscle memory. The counter is simple. File late, carry alternate plans, have an extra plan you never briefed to journalists. If a corridor is pulled at T-minus 1 hour, you take Route C or Serbia first. You land the meeting on time anyway. What about Ukraine trying to do something in the sky? Well, let's be adults about this. A head of state flying with diplomatic clearance, transiting NATO, EU-managed airspace is the last place anyone sane starts an incident. I don't know that they're all sane myself. There's no public evidence Kyiv intends such a move. Doing so would be a direct provocation against authorizing EU NATO states as much as against Russia. The real spoiler, if any, would be paperwork shenanigans, a corridor pulled for technical reasons rather than, you know, any sort of Tom Clancy book. And even there, the more capitals signal readiness to host, the less leverage any single spoiler has. Well, the Russian side has been pretty blunt. The EU's not nice line is optics. The operational reality is that one waiver plus one host is a visible summit. The Bulgarian corridor signal in Russian and framing it as Europeans' first practical step toward a peace venue. The bottom line, the obstacle is the metal, not the man. Article 3D blocks the aircraft till a sovereign EU state grants a flight. Bulgaria offered to do that. Looks like it's going to happen. So, what's the real picture? I believe that is it, don't you? Let's see where we go from here. That was on Ukraine. There's some stories about Ukraine attempting to take out the plane. How is the flight actually protected? Supposedly, there are layers. A legal layer will be state aircraft, diplomatic clearance, is a sovereign authorization. Operational layer, Europe's air policing architecture, watches, identifies in the Russian fighters escort in Russia. Military escorts appear sometimes, from the host state. Electronic layer, guidance is baked into the briefing. Jamming, spoofing is possible, but, I assume the Russian jamming far outclasses ours. Choreography layer, route secrecy. So you've got all of those things that you have. Let's see. Where are we going to go after this? We're running low on time, so I'm going to zip through to the aftermath of the Z-Man and Trump. Let's see. Washington, because there's been some comments about this afterward. Washington hosted the pageant. Budapest now hosting the substance. In between those two, we watched very public recalibration. Trump went into Zelensky meeting, sending two messages at once. Stop the fighting where it is, and don't expect to get any tomahawks. It's not a rumor. That's what he said when he came out. He flagged that Kyiv would press for cruise missiles, and nothing was pledged. Even Axios called the meeting bad, which in diplomatic speak means no deal on missiles. We all saw that poor Z-Man looked like he was crying almost when he walked out. A push toward a frontline ceasefire rather than another round of one more big package. I think we are tired of it, truthfully. On Kyiv's side, the performance was familiar. Declare victory by redefining what victory looks like. Zelensky came out and talked about progress toward getting Patriot systems. 25 of them, he said. I doubt that. While shifting attention away from the failed Tomahawks. That's not a small rhetorical pivot. It's a switch from long-range deep strike narrative to defense. If you're trying to sell the home audience on momentum, Patriots sound like protection. Tomahawk sounds like escalation. And escalation is what Washington avoided over the weekend. The bigger pivot is ceasefire language. Twice, Zelensky publicly aligned with the idea of halting the fight along current lines. Hasn't he been? Have you ever heard him say that before this weekend? You have not. While refusing to hand over additional territory. Strip away what he said and to freeze. Freezing today's map to stop tomorrow's funerals. Trump swatted away the allegation that he demanded Ukraine surrender all of Donbass, saying instead that fighting should stop where it is. That's practically the same idea from opposite podiums. No more advances, no formal sessions now. But I'm telling you, the Donbass is almost all gone. There's very little of it left in Kyiv's hands even now. Now to the Tomahawk saga itself. The week opened with White House expecting you know, expectations. Zelensky's going to ask again. The answer is going to be not now. Washington doesn't have political appetite or inventory to make cruise missiles. Contrast that with Kyiv's declared homework. In his October 15 address and his official website, Zelensky framed Patriots and Tomahawks as tools to lay a long-term foundation of peace. Read this carefully. It's a rhetorical jujitsu match of the moment. Offensive deep strike missiles rebranded as peace. Washington did not buy that pitch. The Patriot framing, however, Washington might be able to live with. They just might. I'm not sure where that goes. Where does this leave war and politics? In classic endgame posture. We might actually pull out of this. This might actually work. I'm really not all that. And they're not bringing the old Z-man. He was asked to be invited, and so far he's got no place, and nobody in Europe is going, except Orban, the only sane one in the room anyway. Kyiv's public stance of no land, no concession, sits next to an emerging operational stance. Freeze the front, refit air defenses, shift debate from maps to mechanisms. That is what you do when your partners are signaling inventory fatigue on the most escalatory hardware, and your battlefield returns per unit of blood are vastly diminished. It isn't capitulation. This is triage. And for Budapest, triage is a feature, not a bug. And the only kind of consensus that can fit into one room is the kind that pauses reality rather than rewrites it. The war spin continues, of course. In Washington press, you get anonymous quotes about profanity and pressure in the meeting. In Ukrainian messaging, you get productive talks. You know, the talk about, oh, gee, we're getting patriots. In Russia-leaning outlets, you get Tomahawks are denied, ceasefire logic is affirmed. The overlap across, the part everyone is admitting, is the freeze. That's the only overlapping circle on your Venn diagrams. Let's look at incentives, because incentives write policy. For Washington, a frontline freeze is the fastest way to stop the burn rate on funds and munitions while claiming diplomatic momentum heading into Budapest. For Moscow, a freeze ratifies a map currently holds without political cost of formal annexation talks in the EU. For Kyiv, a freeze with no additional concession preserves domestic narrative while buying time to harden energy infrastructure for winter and rotate units. For Budapest, a freeze is the only viable product to sell to Brussels. Not capitulation, not recognition, suspension. And the common word here is pause. Will that be enough for the EU chorus? We don't know. Especially since they called Putin's visit not nice. Watch the phrasing. Even as critics wave ICC warrants, Commission quietly confirms there's no EU travel ban. The ministers have begun saying out loud that any step that truly helps peace is welcome. That tells you what they expect. A ceasefire. I'm not sure they're going to get that. Not a final status negotiation. It also explains why the Tomahawk denial matters. If you want Budapest to work, you don't escalate the week before. One more uncomfortable truth. The battlefield is racing the briefings. Every day of fighting nudges the map a little bit. That is why both sides are pushing now before any room in Budapest closes those doors. In that light, Zelensky's pivot to patriots isn't cosmetic. It's strategic. Try to protect his grid, protect the cities, protect the status quo. I saw some reports that they are losing some big ones, and Pokrovsk is just about done. And I'll bet you it'll be done before they go to Budapest. That's what I think. So, I don't know. What should listeners do? I don't know. Watch the language. Does Kyiv continue to halt where it is, or do we hear something else? Tomahawks done. Frontline freeze on the table. Zelensky, patriots, no concessions. Trump sells, stop where you are. Moscow hears both, hears the same sentence. If Budapest happens, expect silence. Not a treaty, not a parade. Artillery. falling below the threshold where headlines move on. That may be unsatisfying to maximalists, but it might be life-saving to civilians who just want a warm apartment in January winter in Ukraine. This is International Flavor. I am Samuel Trapp. I appreciate you joining me this evening. I hope you join me every night just because I like it. If you go to internationalflavor.com, you can hear all past shows at your convenience and listen to them. You can also hear them if you go to damradio.com/podcasts, as you can also hear other commentators on damradio.com. I appreciate you being here. Thanks for doing so.